It's Thanksgiving in the United States, but the shelling continues in Ukraine.
At least six people were killed during attacks that targeted energy facilities, cutting power in many regions and forcing emergency blackouts elsewhere.
Plus, celebrity chef Jose Andreas heads up the World Central Kitchen, preparing food in disaster zones all over the world. We'll find out what he's up to in Ukraine.
We humans, we have a very unique connection to food. The first thing we receive in the form of love in the moment we're born is when our mother brings us to her body and gives us food.
And also in today's program, we'll get a lesson on nuclear power plants, and we'll find out just how much danger the Zaporizhia plant is in. Today is November 24th. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. Russian missiles on Wednesday knocked out electricity in the Kyiv region and elsewhere across the country, killing at least six people during attacks that caused widespread blackouts. Tamara Lindstrom from Reuters has the report.
Russian missiles rained down on Ukraine Wednesday, knocking out electricity in the Kyiv region and elsewhere across the country. At least six people were killed during attacks that targeted energy facilities, cutting power in many regions and forcing emergency blackouts elsewhere, as Moscow pushed a campaign to plunge Ukrainian cities into darkness and cold with winter setting in. Emergency crews rushed patients into a Kyiv hospital Wednesday after the strikes, though power to the hospital was also cut, forcing staff to use generators and stored water. The entire capital region, with over 3 million people, was deprived of power and running water, according to the governor. The lack of power forced the shutdown of nuclear reactors in Ukraine's south and west, all in government-held territory, according to the state-run nuclear energy firm. Ukraine's largest nuclear complex at Zaporizhia, near the front lines in the south, is Russian-controlled and was previously switched off because of shelling that both sides blame on each other. A maternity hospital in the region was destroyed by shelling Wednesday. Officials said a doctor and a patient were pulled from the debris, but a two-day-old baby was killed. Ukraine's top military commander said air defenses shot down 51 of 67 Russian cruise missiles launched on Wednesday, including 20 of the 30 that targeted Kyiv. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the attacks targeted infrastructure, energy, and regular civilians.
The result is tragic. There is a big number of wounded. There are killed ones. Please accept my condolences, all who lost relatives and close ones. Concerning electricity and water supply, everyone is working. Electricians are working. Rescue servicemen are working. Everyone is working. Local authorities, the task is set. We will rebuild everything. We will get through it all because we are an unbreakable people.
Since October, Russia has openly acknowledged targeting Ukraine's civil power and heating systems with long-range missiles and drones. Moscow says the aim is to reduce Kyiv's ability to fight and push it to negotiate. Ukraine says the strikes on infrastructure are war crimes. Russia denies its troops deliberately attack civilians or have committed atrocities.
Reuters' Tamara Lindstrom reporting. So, as we've just heard, shelling and finger-pointing has intensified around the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. I wanted to get a clearer understanding of the risks involved, but most of the guests we have on this show are military or political experts, not scientists. And I am certainly no scientist either. So, I found a scientist to help us clear some things up. Jacopo Bongiorno is a professor of nuclear engineering and director of the Center for Advanced Nuclear Energy Systems at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he's published 90 articles about nuclear reactor safety and design. I started by asking him just what's the worst that could happen.
Well, the worst that can happen is that many barriers that exist to prevent the release of radioactivity, which is generated by all nuclear reactors, if those barriers are breached, there is the potential for a release of that radioactivity into the environment. But I want to be clear, we're nowhere close to that scenario at the moment for a number of reasons, particularly at Zaporizhia. The first one being that all six reactors have been shut down for 2 months. And so the level of radioactivity and the so-called decay heat, which provides kind of a driving force for that radioactivity to be released, are way, way down from what they would normally be if the reactors had been operating at 100% power.
And it seems like that's good news. I was under the impression there could be a huge explosion.
Yeah, well, the one thing that maybe that should be clarified is these plants cannot explode like nuclear bombs. So I don't know if that's clear to you, but that's a concern that some people might have. It's just physically impossible. That's not how nuclear reactors work. So the worst that can happen is not an explosion in a sense of a nuclear bomb, but the worst that can happen is breaching of those barriers and then a release of radioactivity from the reactor core.
If there was a direct hit to the nuclear power plant, how large an area could be affected by radiation?
Well, it really depends on how big the explosion is and which parts of the nuclear plant are going to be hit. So I'm not answering your question directly because it really depends on how big and where it hits. But I guess the message I want to make sure gets clearly across is that it's not easy to create a radiological event or release of radioactivity in these plants because they're designed to be very, very sturdy.
One of the things we've heard about is that the plant itself has backup generators for the cooling system. What are the cooling systems used for, and what would happen if they stop working?
Okay, so all nuclear reactors are heat sources, right? There is a nuclear reaction, it's called fission, that produces enormous amounts of heat when the reactor is in normal operations. And the interesting thing from a physical point of view about nuclear reactors is that after you have nominally shut down, after you have sort of stopped that self-sustaining chain reaction, that fission reaction, the reactor continues to produce a little bit of heat. We call it the decay heat. So all of this to say that you can never completely shut down a nuclear reactor. And so cooling systems are in place to remove that lingering decay heat. And you have to do that for a long period of time. If you did not remove it, then the temperatures in the reactor core would start to go up and you could basically end up melting the fuel or anyway damaging the core. That's bad, not because melting per se is bad, but because that in turn releases some of the radioactivity. And that's why we have this containment structure, reinforced concrete, that keeps it in. So now back to your question. There are backup generators, and in fact, there are so-called emergency diesel generators. All nuclear reactors have those, and Ukrainian reactors are no exception, that ensure that the core, that the reactors are cooled long-term. If those emergency diesel generators are disabled for whatever reason, there are backup generators, and I think that's what you were referring to also at the site. But those backup generators are, again, diesels, and so if you run out of diesel, then basically this process of temperature starting to escalate within the core starts, and that could damage the core, the reactor, and then eventually you could have a release. Once again, at this point, the amount of radioactivity in those reactors and the decay heat, this lingering decay heat, are very, very low, so there is not a lot of driving force for that radioactivity to come out.
Professor Jacopo Bongiorno of MIT. Now it's time for our update from Kyiv. Joining us, as always, is Anna Chernikova. She'll give us an update on the front lines, plus some new developments from Belarus.
The hottest spots at the front line remain in the east and in the south, particularly the city of Bakhmut in the Donetsk region, where the most heavy fightings are happening at the moment.
I understand you have an update for us regarding Belarus.
Actually, today, Ukrainian general staff had this report saying that it looks like that up to 15,000 Belarus soldiers might be ready to actually enter this war directly and are ready to actually join Russian forces in the war in Ukraine. And of course, this is something that we cannot verify independently, and we cannot verified from different sources except of the general staff of Ukraine. However, this information was in the informational space for some time now, and Ukrainian security services and Ukrainian military officials were always highlighting that this so-called Belarus risk, the risk that Belarus army might also be involved directly in the war, is very high. And when I'm saying directly, involved directly, meaning that people would actually go fighting. Because, of course, we all know that the territory of Belarus is already used by Russian forces for attacks in Ukraine, and it is used from day one of this war.
And changing gears a bit, we're going to hear from you later in the program as well. You'll introduce us to a family who's had to change their family business. Can you give us a little preview? Tell us who we're going to meet and what they're doing.
When the full-scale invasion started, a lot of people in Ukraine, a lot of families had to rethink their lives and especially their businesses, because a lot of businesses of Ukrainian families just stuck at one point and just stuck overnight. And this is a story about a family of architecture and design business owners who also thought that their business might be over, but then they found new meaning, they found new values, and they basically reshaped a little bit, and they created this really cool and very inspiring project called Relocation UA, which is aiming to relocate those people in Ukraine who lost their homes. And then he decided that it would be really great to combine his family business and this new idea of helping people, helping Ukrainians. They are creating this relocation settlement. It's in process. And already two families found their new home there, and we will hear from one of those.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
When Anna Chernikova is not on the phone giving us updates from Kyiv, she's a reporter traveling around the country, digging up important stories. Today, she tells us how many are forced to adapt and innovate to cope with the endless devastation of constant attacks. We'll hear the story of one family business that is not only surviving, but thriving, turning tragedy into hope. Here's Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
Russian forces show no signs of letting up their campaign of devastation across Ukraine. And that means business people like the Nadashkivsky family, who own and operate an architecture and design business, have had to retool. With the full-scale assault on February 24th, orders for remodeling and new construction disappeared overnight.
Business is an entire life for us. We have been engaged in construction and design for 20 years. It is an integral part of our life. Therefore, there was a feeling that everything was ruined at once. It was very scary.
Their son, Yehor, started a volunteering mission with his friend a few weeks into the war. He then came up with an idea to keep the family business going while helping his nation. This is how the Relocation UA project was created. The team then went to work, designing and building modular homes for Ukraine's rapidly growing number of internally displaced people.
Why modular houses? They are quick to make and transport. At the moment, some areas in Ukraine are occupied and some are under active shelling and hostilities. This technology allows us to build a modular settlement and then, for example, disassemble and transport these houses where needed.
This settlement, the first that Relocation UA is building, is located in the village of Vyznitsa, a picturesque area of western Ukraine. The project, funded by foreign investors, aims to relocate more than 100 families. Halina and her daughter Alena were among the first to find their new home here. They evacuated from the heavily shelled city of Orikhiv in the Zaporizhia region after their house was destroyed. Alena's father, a soldier, was killed in a battle near Izum last May.
My ex-husband died in the war. It was announced that houses were to be given to the families of soldiers or those who died in the war. Therefore, we contacted the foundation, and they told us that we would get this house. It's very calm here. We feel safe here.
The goal is to provide new homes for people in the short term. Priority is given to the families of fallen soldiers and those currently fighting at the front line.
I want to do something so that when my daughter asks, she won't remember the war, of course. I hope she won't. But when she is asked, she can say that her dad did something useful.
Apart from devastation, the war has also given a start to many new ventures. Finding new meaning and reaffirming their values, Ukrainian business owners, like the Nedashkivsky family, carry on. Anna Chernikova for VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Ukraine from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish. Jose Andreas is the head of the World Central Kitchen, and it's likely you'll find him wherever people are in need. This Thanksgiving, I caught up with him in Mykolaiv and spoke about the importance of food to the human soul and how he's able to serve over 100 million meals in Ukraine and the surrounding area.
Very much we are an organization that does food emergency. When a hurricane, when an earthquake, when a volcano, when mayhem happens, we show up and we make sure that the population that is being affected has food and has water. That's what World Central Kitchen is.
And what are you doing in Ukraine? What kind of food are you able to provide?
Well, in Ukraine, we've been here very much since 24 hours after the unjust and unfair Russian invasion into Ukraine, and we began in the border in Poland, taking care of the Ukrainian refugees living the horrors of war. Very quickly, we were in every single point, not only in Poland, but in the other countries surrounding Ukraine. And we began also doing feeding 24/7 hours operations in the middle of February, when the temperatures were so cold that every woman, every elderly, every child were freezing. Very quickly, we began operations inside, from Lviv to Kyiv, very quickly expanding to every other major city, taking care of the people displaced inside Ukraine. And since then, we've done close to 180 million meals. We've been in more than 1,000 cities and villages. We've been with more than 8,000 points of distribution, with more than 550 Ukrainian restaurants in our network, with warehouses and trains and trucks, distributing food all across Ukraine. And right now, we are very heavily concentrated in the city of Kherson and the entire region of Kherson, making sure that the villages and the city itself have the food and the water they need.
Now, I know you are a chef, but an operation of this scale is so much more than knowing how to cook. How can you handle the logistics, the transportation, the energy required to make 100 million meals?
Well, because we have an army of 4,000 or 5,000 people, because we've been, obviously, if you follow us now for a few years, you will see that we've been in places that nobody else sometimes has responded. In the Bahamas, we were able to reach 80,000 meals a day right after Dorian, Hurricane 5 category, decimated the northern part of the Bahamas. That's what we do. We are a small organization, but we scale fast and quick. When we came into Ukraine, we were only two people of World Central Kitchen, but very quickly we were able to build a team of more than 4,000 that allow us to precisely grow quick, because the needs of the Ukrainians kept growing as the Russians keep obviously attacking. That's what we do.
And what kind of food are you able to prepare?
Well, we try always to buy local, so you need to understand that when you are in a country like Ukraine, you're going to see a lot of borscht, and you're going to see a lot of cabbage, and you're going to see a lot of the ingredients. Everywhere we go, we always try to use the local ingredients, in the case of the hot foods, or the local food products that we can be buying. It's very important that we go to a place, we try to leave as much money as we can inside the local economy. In the process, you are not only taking care of the problem, feeding the people that may need food, But in the process, you are investing in the solution. At least you keep people employed, you keep the economy running. Every dollar stays local. We've been having at the beginning to be bringing food from other countries in Europe for obvious reasons. This country was in disarray. But when we can, we always do local food because that's what people can cook better. It's nothing new they have to learn. And especially when you're using local chefs to make the hot meals in this case. But also we buy local products that allow us, as I say, keep the factories open and keep the system of food production alive.
How do you get local food in a war-torn place?
Well, when you follow the war in Ukraine, you will see that now every part of Ukraine it's in a conflict zone. It's obviously the front lines, especially in the east, north, and south. We need to remember that Ukraine, technically, they don't have a problem with food production. It's a country that exports food for centuries. Ukraine has been not only feeding itself, but feeding many other countries in Europe and beyond what Ukraine needs. And that's why we are here. It's used logistics and infrastructure. And that's what we, as World Central Kitchen, are maintaining and are providing to make sure that the food keeps flowing to those people that don't have access because their supermarkets are closed, because the bridges are broken. We make sure that in our emergency action, we solve those problems and bring food to them.
It's Thanksgiving in the United States, clearly a food-centric holiday. Do you feel your work takes on more meaning on a day like this?
You know, now that we are celebrating Thanksgiving, it's such an important moment in America that brings all Americans together. It's a matter if you are a Democrat or a Republican, if you are 10 generations American or a brand new immigrant. Thanksgiving brings all of us together, longer tables. We humans, we have a very unique connection to food. The first thing we receive in the form of love in the moment we're born is when our mother brings us to her body and give us food. This is the first tangible we receive. And the tangible is food. That's why food is so inside of who we are. Every time we're bringing a meal, especially in these cities that they have nothing, that you give them a piece of bread and people hug you for 5 minutes. That's the moment that you see how humans, how together we are next to food. Tell me what you eat and I'll tell you who you are. But in this case, it's so much more. It's just we need to be next to the people in their darkest hour in this war that is unfair. And I hope all Americans and all people around the world on this amazing Thanksgiving day that makes me so proud to be American, that we will remember that they are Ukrainians, that they're going to go back hungry, cold, but hopeful, because it's organizations like Food Central Kitchen, supported by many Americans, that we are here next to them so they don't walk alone in this dark hour. Let's pray for all of them. Let's make sure that we celebrate Thanksgiving, but that we remember that these people need more than our prayers. They need our respect, and we need to be next to them.
That's Jose Andreas from the World Central Kitchen. And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.